This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Good evening and welcome to the Birch Aquarium at Scripps Institution of Oceanography at UC San Diego. My name is Nigella Hilgarth, and I'm the executive director here at the Birch Aquarium, and I'm delighted to welcome you to the latest Jeffrey B. Graham Perspectives on Ocean Science lecture. And it is my great pleasure to introduce tonight's speaker, Dr. Andy Nozell, who is going to speak to us on a very familiar subject tonight. In fact, I think many of you heard Andy speak last year and know that he is a remarkably good public speaker. He is now a postdoctoral researcher at Scripps Institution of Oceanography, and he's the Birch Aquarium Delacour Fellow in Ecology and Conservation. And we're very proud and excited to have Andy as part of our team. And he did his undergraduate work at the University of Virginia. He did his bachelor's in biology, specialization in environmental and biological conservation. And his doctoral thesis was, which will come as no surprise to those of you who know him at all, which is on leopard sharks. And, of course, his advisor was Dr. Jeffrey Graham, in whose memory this lecture series is named, the Jeffrey B. Graham Lecture Series on Perspectives on Ocean Science. And so it's particularly poignant to have one of his students, one of Jeff's students tonight, give this talk. So it's not surprising that Andy studies all things shark and shark's relatives. He's especially interested in spatial ecology and population structure of sharks, especially leopard sharks. So please join me in welcoming Andy Nozell for his presentation titled Shark Conservation, Safeguarding the Future of Our Ocean.
Thank you, Nigella. Good evening, everyone. Thank you very much for coming. My message tonight is simple. As much as we love dolphins, we must also love sharks. That's it. Shark populations are declining worldwide rapidly because of human activities. And at best, we don't seem to really notice. And at worst, we don't seem to really care. You see, if the animal caught in that net behind me were a dolphin, or a seal, whale, or sea turtle, then we would notice. Then we would care. We would be outraged because we love dolphins, seals, whales, and sea turtles. We don't love sharks in the same way. On the contrary, many people are terrified of sharks, and some are even unwilling to conserve them because they fear the prospect of having even more sharks in the water than there are today. Now, a healthy respect for sharks, which at times may understandably manifest itself as a fear, is perfectly natural, perfectly acceptable. But the mass hysteria and the negative attitude towards sharks that so often ensues every time a shark bites a person, every time a shark is sighted, even at the mere mention of the word shark, is completely unfounded and actually hindering conservation efforts. So what I hope to convince you of tonight is that sharks are not so scary. They're actually beautiful, ecologically essential, and whose benefit to humans, which is so often overlooked, is not worthy at all of the way in which our society has vilified these animals. So to that end, I want to start by showing the original theatrical trailer to the movie Jaws, because this got the shark-hating party started. Released on June 20th, 1975, Jaws was the first summer blockbuster. It was the highest-grossing film to date, complete breakthrough for Steven Spielberg as a director. The musical score, composed by John Williams, remains one of the most recognizable in history. You all know it. If you don't, you'll recognize it very soon, because you're going to hear it. The legacy of this film cannot be understated. Just as Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho in 1960 made taking a shower just a little bit scarier, Jaws made getting into the ocean a lot scarier, with surfers and swimmers constantly wondering what could be lurking beneath them, looking back up at their legs from under the sea. So this movie caused beach attendance to be down. that summer of 1975. But nearly 40 years later, Jaws continues to strike fear in beachgoers. And so the effects are still very well present today, very noticeable. So as you watch the trailer, listen especially to the narration and the way in which sharks are described and portrayed, and reflect on the extent to which this film might have even contributed to your own fear of sharks. So here is Jaws.
There is a creature alive today who has survived millions of years of evolution without change, without passion, and without logic. It lives to kill. A mindless eating machine. It will attack and devour anything. It is as if God created the devil and gave him jaws. This is Universal's extraordinary motion picture version of Peter Benchley's best-selling novel, Jaws.
I just found out that a girl got killed here last week. And you knew it. You knew there was a shark out there. You knew it was dangerous. But you let people go swimming anyway.
That most people get attacked by sharks in 3 feet of water, about 10 feet from the beach.
Yeah.
What we are dealing with here is a perfect engine, an eating machine.
We're not only going to have to close the beach, we're going to have to hire somebody to kill the shark.
Bad fish. But I'll catch him. I'll kill him.
Did you hear your father? I'm the woman now.
This shark, swallow you whole.
You're going to need a bigger boat.
Three tons on them.
Hurry up, he's coming straight for us. Don't screw it up now. Don't wait for me. Now! Shoot!
Man's fantasies of evil can compare with the reality of Jaws. Roy Scheider, Robert Shaw, Richard Dreyfuss, Jaws. See it before you go swimming.
Well, we're off to a great start. So, see it before you go swimming. Well, people did. And now, this is what most people think of when they hear the word shark, right? A big old great white shark with a mouth full of teeth coming at you. This is the first point that I want to make tonight. From now on, when you hear the word shark, I don't want you to first think of the great white, because the great white is only one of more than 400 different species of shark alive today. They come in all different shapes, sizes, colors, exhibit all different kinds of behaviors. When you hear the word shark, think first of the diversity. Don't immediately think of the great white. Some sharks are big, like the whale shark. Some are small, like the pygmy shark. Some swim constantly in the open ocean, while others can rest on the sea floor. Some sharks are cute. Some sharks are cuter. Some sharks have big mouths. Some have long tails, and some have heads shaped like hammers. Some sharks swim in schools. Other sharks cruise solo. Some sharks can jump clear out of the water, spinning 5 to 8 times. And some just prefer to walk. When you hear the word shark from now on, think of this slide. Think first of the diversity, the beautiful diversity of sharks. The next thing you should think of when you hear the word shark is how important sharks are, not only for the marine environment, but also to humans. Sharks are essential ecologically because they are top predators, or apex predators. And as top predators, they directly control their prey populations. And as the number of apex predators declines because of human activities, and we'll get to those in a minute, that top-down control is released. So without these predators, their prey start to increase. We broadly call these mesopredators, or middle predators, smaller sharks, certain fish, rays. And when those mesopredators increase in population, they tend to deplete their own prey, which are broadly called resource species. These can include certain kinds of small fish, invertebrates, even seagrass. And we tend to call this a trophic cascade. This is a domino effect, a cascade through the different feeding levels of the food chain, initiated by removing that top or apex predator. As an example, it has been suggested that the increase in the cow-nose ray population in the mid-Atlantic, this is off the coast of Virginia, North Carolina, and Maryland, is due in part because their natural predators have been depleted. Large sharks in the Atlantic Ocean have declined by more than 90%, and we're going to get to that in a minute. And as these cow-nose rays increase in number, they all got to eat, and so they tend to deplete their prey, which are various shellfish species, and certain species, like the bay scallop, their fishery has all but collapsed there. Another example. It has been suggested that the population increase and expansion of the jumbo squid throughout the western coast of North America is due in part to the depletion of their natural predators, for example, mako sharks. And you can see these have actually the battle scars from eating some of those jumbo squid. And as these jumbo squid increase in their population, they deplete their own prey, and now the Pacific hake industry has all but collapsed as well. Now, obviously, there are more details. I'm simplifying things here. The underlying mechanisms guiding all of these population changes is still the subject of some debate and also the subject of ongoing research. But these are the kinds of effects that we can expect as shark populations continue to decline. So sharks are important ecologically. They're also important directly to humans as a relatively inexpensive source of protein. In some parts of the world, shark meat is the only source of protein. So I'm not here tonight to say that we need to stop fishing sharks altogether, but we do need to reach some sort of sustainable balance so that we have sharks into the future so that everybody can benefit from them, including the people that perhaps rely on them the most. And sharks are important to humans because of ecotourism. The revenue that they generate is amazing. People will spend thousands of dollars, travel halfway around the world for the opportunity to share the company of a shark in its natural environment, whether it's cage diving with white sharks, swimming beside whale sharks, scuba diving with reef sharks, or even snorkeling and kayaking with our local leopard sharks. It's been shown time and again that a living shark is worth far more over the course of its lifetime than a dead shark that is killed instantaneously and the meat used for food. But despite the importance of sharks, shark populations are declining rapidly. The underlying reason for these declines is the inherent vulnerability that is encompassed in their life history characteristics. Namely, sharks are long-lived, in some cases living 50 to 100 years. They grow very slowly. They mature late in life. Many sharks don't mature until they're halfway through their life cycle, which would be like a human not reaching reproductive maturity until they're 40 years old. They have very long gestation periods, often between 1 and 2 years, sometimes longer than 2 years, which is much longer than a human, which is, of course, only 9 months. And sharks produce relatively few offspring, as few as 1 or 2 at a time. And altogether, this is a formula for disaster. All of these traits contribute to that inherently low potential to recover from a population decline, which is why we need to take proactive measures to prevent these declines from happening and stop them immediately, the ones that are already happening, so that we can give the sharks the best opportunity possible for them to recover. But it's going to take time. It's going to take many years for shark populations to recover. That's why shark populations are declining, because of overfishing. Overfishing is simply the removal of sharks from the water at a rate that's faster than they can reproduce and replace themselves in the population, so that we end up with a net decrease of sharks in the water. This picture was taken at a commercial shark processing plant in Miyagi Prefecture in Japan. And this happens every day, by the way, at just one location. But it's not just these large-scale commercial fisheries we have to watch out for. We also have to keep an eye on the small-scale, or what is often called artisanal, shark fisheries. These are much smaller operations, usually a couple of guys. They rent a boat, they go out for a couple of days, fish as much as they can, they bring what they can back, they sell some of it, use some of it to feed their families. This is why shark conservation is so complicated, because you don't want to just deprive these people of a livelihood and say that they can't feed their families. After all, they're just trying to get by too. But at the same time, we do need to strike some balance, because if we don't, then there won't be sharks in the future for even them. Perhaps the biggest threat facing sharks is the act of finning. And we're going to talk about finning in just a moment, but first let's talk about the shark fins themselves. The fins are the most valuable part of the shark. We'll talk about exactly how valuable they are in just a moment. The shark fins are acquired all over the world, and typically they are first shipped to Hong Kong, which is the shark fin trade capital of the world, and that is where they are dried on rooftops in large numbers, as you see there. And from Hong Kong, the shark fins that are processed are redistributed all around the world, and they even come here to the United States. The shark fins, as many of you know, are used to make shark fin soup, among other shark fin products, which is an expensive Asian delicacy. At high-end restaurants, it can cost up to $100 per bowl. The reason shark fin soup is so expensive is because the fins themselves are so expensive. So here, if you take a close look at this market in Hong Kong, these shark fins cost $246 per pound. This compared to only a few dollars per pound for the shark meat. Now, that disparity between the high-value shark fins and the low-value shark meat create the incentive to fin the sharks at sea. So what this means is the sharks are captured at sea, they're brought onto the boat, because time is usually of the essence. Their fins are sliced off while they're still alive. And because hull space is usually limited, and a hull that is filled with fins alone is worth far more than a hull that is filled with both the fins and the corresponding carcasses, the carcasses are usually tossed overboard. If the shark is still alive, it sinks very slowly, and it bleeds to death. So needless to say, this is a very cruel practice, but I think worst of all, it's wasteful, considering how many people around the world are starving, malnourished, and the shark fins themselves only account for about 5% at the most of the entire body weight of the shark. And I would liken shark finning to killing an elephant just for its tusks. Extremely cruel and extremely wasteful. A recent paper that just came out this year in the Journal of Marine Policy confirms the long-believed estimate that on average 100 million sharks are killed every year by humans. Compare that to on average 4 to 6 humans killed every year by sharks. Of those 100 million sharks killed every year, 35% are landed whole. That is, the shark meat and the fins are both brought back to port. Of those 100 million, 2% are actually released, but later die from injuries that were sustained during the catch and release process. But 63% of the sharks that are killed every year are finned and discarded. And this amounts to 2 billion pounds of shark meat wasted annually, which is enough to satisfy the protein requirements for 50 million people every year. Because we're removing sharks at this rate, 100 million sharks per year, it is estimated that the shark population has declined by 90%. This is a widely accepted figure, 90%, but of course it is an average, right? Some sharks are doing better, some sharks are doing worse. But that figure of 90% is pretty consistent, whether we're talking about gray reef sharks and white-tip reef sharks in the Central Pacific, oceanic white tips or silky sharks in the Gulf of Mexico, blue and thresher sharks in the Mediterranean Sea, and hammerhead and poor beagle sharks in the Northwest Atlantic. Many of the large shark species are down by at least 90%. But perhaps the most threatening to sharks is the negative public perception. Sharks have a bad rap. Okay? Because that is what most people think of when they hear the word shark. Hopefully not you all tonight, but most people think of that. They're afraid of being killed by a shark. Now, some of you may have heard statistics like, you're more likely to be killed by a falling coconut than you are by a shark. You're more likely to be killed by a vending machine falling on you than you are a shark. That's probably true, but I don't know who keeps those statistics, so I'm going to show you some real statistics right now. The odds of any American in the United States being killed by a shark at any time in their life, 1 in almost 4 million. To put that into perspective, the odds of being dealt a royal flush in the opening hand of five-card poker, 1 in 650,000. So if you go to the casino tonight after the presentation, you're 6 times more likely to be dealt a royal flush, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, than you are of dying from a shark. The odds of dying are 1 in 1. The time and the place and the way that it happens is going to vary, but very unlikely that it's going to happen because of a shark. Another way to say this is that about 1 person every year in the United States dies from a shark bite. Compare that to the number of people that die every year from snake bites, from dog maulings, train crash, lightning strike, a deer collision, plane crash, drowning, suicide, an auto accident. If we're more afraid dying from a shark than we are dying in a car crash or getting cancer, I think we're doing a lot of unnecessary worrying. The statistics don't support the fear. The statistics show that the fear of sharks is completely irrational, completely disproportionate to the threat. But yet, the fear persists. And I believe this is the reason why. There are really only 3 ways in which people can experience sharks, get information about sharks, learn about sharks. The first way is through direct personal encounters, that is actually sharing the company of the shark in its natural environment. And aside from the exceedingly rare shark bite, these kinds of direct personal encounters are entirely positive. You talk to any scuba diver that has been fortunate enough to have swam with sharks, and they'll tell you it was the most amazing experience of their life. Or just swimming with our local leopard sharks. Absolutely amazing. But let's be real. We're very lucky here in San Diego. Not everybody has leopard sharks in their backyard to go swim with. So, and most people can't fly halfway around the world. They can't take a lot of time off from work. So most people are not going to be able to have these positive, direct personal encounters. So the next most common way in which people experience sharks is at aquariums and zoos. You can go see whale sharks at the Georgia Aquarium in Atlanta. You can see juvenile white sharks at the Monterey Bay Aquarium. You can see wonderful local sharks like the leopard shark here at the Birch Aquarium. But again, not everybody lives near an aquarium. Not everybody can afford to go to an aquarium. So the way in which most people get their information about sharks is through the mass media. Through movies, which we know do a great job of portraying sharks fairly, the news, which is always fair and impartial, and documentaries, which you think is should be fair to sharks, but as I'm going to show you, sometimes even documentaries play into these negative stereotypes. So what I want to show you now is how the mass media tends to twist things and really portray sharks in a negative light so that you're aware of it and you don't sort of fall victim to the sensationalism. Now, since Jaws, there have been a few other shark movies to come out. Jaws 1, Jaws 2, Jaws 3D, Jaws the Revenge. Then there was Shark Attack 1, Shark Attack 2, Shark Attack 3, Megalodon. Then there was just Megalodon. Shark Hunter, Shark Zone, Red Water, Open Water, Deep Blue Sea, Shark Night 3D, that one was a good one, Blue Demon, Swamp Shark, Shark Swarm, Mega Shark versus Crocosaurus, Mega Shark versus Giant Octopus, Sharktopus, Dino Shark, Jurassic Shark, things got weird with Hammerhead, and even weirder with Two-Headed Shark Attack. Then we went on location with Spring Break Shark Attack, Malibu Shark Attack in the Mediterranean, Shark in Venice. Not even Snooki was safe in Jersey Shore Shark Attack. And this year we have the highly anticipated sand sharks, avalanche sharks, and Sharknado. Yes, Sharknado is happening. Now, The bad news is that there is a common theme here, and it's not that the shark is the protagonist, right? The good news, however, is that we've come a long way from Jaws, a very well-made, realistic, frightening movie, to Sharknado, which I haven't seen yet, but I suspect is pretty ridiculous. In a way, these bad shark movies, I mean, a bad shark movie is now a thing now. Bad shark movies come out every single year. There are people that host and go to bad shark movie nights where we just make fun of the movies and it's actually really good. The good news here is that these movies are kind of parodies of Jaws, and they sort of make fun of people's fear of sharks. And so if we're going to see a silver lining, maybe that's it. But anyway, movies typically don't portray sharks fairly. With the news, there are a lot of really good journalists out there, and there's a lot of reputable news organizations, but so often we see titles like this: Bodyboarder cut in half in horrific shark attack off Australian coast. Bodyboarder, California bodyboarder killed in gruesome shark attack. Vicious shark attack leaves man dead in New Zealand. Okay, here's the first problem. These words: horrific, gruesome, vicious. A gruesome shark attack, as opposed to what? Like a nice, happy, fun shark attack? I think by definition, a shark attack is inherently gruesome. And there's no need to sensationalize adding these unnecessary adjectives that only serve to elicit negative emotion in your audience. The second issue I take to these is the overuse of the phrase shark attack. The word attack carries with it a lot of negative baggage. It implies some sort of intent. Terrorists attack. Do sharks really attack? They bite, but do they attack? And a new paper that just came out in the Journal of Environmental Studies and Sciences just this year suggests that we should start to phase out the use of the word attack from our public discourse of shark-human interactions. I tend to agree with this. I really think that the word attack, it has negative implications, and it's perhaps a little misleading, saying more than it may really be the case. We don't know why sharks bite humans. It seems, in most cases, the case of mistaken identity. The shark thinks you're its normal prey item. And so to call something an attack, which is really a freak accident, may not be quite appropriate. And then we see garbage like this. Two fall into shark-infested waters on Carnival cruise. U.S. tourists survive 12-hour ordeal in shark-infested Caribbean waters. Fishermen survive shark-infested waters for 25 days floating on icebox. Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, the problem? Shark-infested waters. Have you ever thought that that phrase makes absolutely no sense? If you read these titles, yeah, you see shark-infested. Then you go and you read the article underneath the title, not a single mention of sharks. Nobody was bit by a shark, nobody saw a shark, maybe you thought about a shark. But then why are these waters shark-infested? Is it because the sharks live there? If that's the case, then these waters are equally infested with dolphins and seals and whales and sea turtles. But you would never see fishermen survive dolphin-infested waters for 25 days floating on icebox. You might think, oh, did the dolphins help? No. If dolphin-infested waters sound absolutely ridiculous to you, it should. But so should shark-infested waters. The word infest, so negative. Termites infest houses. Rats infest the sewers. Sharks cannot infest the ocean. That's their home. We cannot make areas that are abundant in sharks into something negative. An abundance of sharks has become synonymous with a balanced and thriving ecosystem. So sharks do not infest waters. Maybe the waters are teeming with sharks or thriving with sharks, but not infested with sharks. If sharks get into your bathtub, maybe those waters are shark-infested because the sharks don't belong there. But if anything, the waters are kind of infested with humans. We don't belong there. That's not our home. At best, we share that home with the sharks. And when we get into that water, we assume a certain very small risk, just like we assume a risk when we get into our car and drive to work every day. Finally, documentaries. Most documentaries are very educational, have an excellent message. Sometimes the message is kind of buried, but have you ever noticed the background music that usually accompanies shark footage? Usually it's pretty scary, kind of like Jaws, uneasy, suspenseful. In contrast, have you ever noticed the background music that usually accompanies dolphin footage? Usually it's happy and uplifting and majestic. Okay. The purpose of music in film is very deliberate. It's to engage the audience on an emotional level. It is to set the mood. It is a way for the filmmaker to add commentary and judgment without saying a word. When you have sharps with scary music, it reinforces negative stereotypes. It is a tacit validation of people's negative preconceived notions about sharks. So what I'm going to do now is show you two clips from Discovery Channel's Blue Planet series. The first one is of dolphins. The second one will be of sharks. These two clips were taken within about 5 minutes of each other in the exact same episode. So first, we're going to watch the nice, beautiful dolphins. Right? Yeah, they're so beautiful. Okay. 5 minutes later, in the exact same episode, here come the scary sharks. Really? They're just swimming. They're minding their own business, and you would think that they were about to go kill a bunch of people. But this is the way it always is. The sharks always have the scary music. The dolphins always have the nice, happy music. Now, just to make a point, and to give the dolphins a taste of their own medicine, I decided to switch the music. And I think you'll get the idea in just a moment. So now we're going to watch the not-so-nice dolphins. See, now they're not so nice, right? Now it's like they're a little evil, like they're plotting something. Okay, and now we're going to see the majestic sharks. You see? Okay, so I hope Discovery Channel is watching this. It's not fair. The sharks always get the scary music and the dolphins always get the nice happy music. Why is it that the dolphins always get the nice happy music? Is it because it looks like they're smiling? Let me tell you something, that's not smiling. It's just the way its face got stuck during evolution. Look, if that's smiling, then so is that. So we need to get the sharks with the nice happy music because that's what they deserve. But shark conservation is advancing. However, I would say that it is advancing way too slowly. We're going to talk about some of the progress that's been made. But why has it taken so long to get such meager progress? And the simple answer is because we do not love sharks. What do we love? You didn't think I was going to play the whole thing, did you? No. What do we love? We love Flipper and this impossibly cute seal, and all we love Shamu. Okay, I've been a little hard on dolphins tonight. Maybe it's just because I'm jealous. Mostly I'm just being facetious. There's nothing wrong with loving marine mammals. In fact, it's that love of marine mammals that got us the Marine Mammal Protection Act in the United States, which is perhaps the single most comprehensive protective measure for any group of animals on the planet. Under the Marine Mammal Protection Act, you cannot kill, hurt, harass, approach too closely any marine mammal. And we got that law because we love these animals and we put pressure on our politicians to enact legislation to protect them. Can you imagine if we loved sharks as much as we love dolphins? But as I said, things are looking up. Things are improving for sharks, even the way sharks are being portrayed in kids' movies. I'm going to show you now a clip of Finding Nemo, where the sharks are not portrayed as mindless eating machines. They're actually funny. They've got characters and names, and they're kind of on a 12-step program to get off of eating fish. So watch Finding Nemo.
Right then. The meeting has officially come to order. Let us all say the pledge. I am a nice shark, not a mindless eating machine. If I am to change this image, I must first change myself. Fish are friends, not food.
Except stinking dolphins.
Dolphins? Yeah, they think they're so cute. Oh, look at me, I'm a flippin' little dolphin. Let me flip for you, ain't I something?
Right then, today's meeting is step 5. Bring a fish friend. Now, do you all have your friends?
Got mine.
Hey there.
How about you, chum?
Oh, well, I seem to have misplaced my friend.
It's all right, chum. I had a feeling this would be a difficult step. You can help yourself to one of my friends.
Oh, thanks, mate. A little chum for chum, eh?
I'll start the testimonies. Hello. My name is Bruce.
Hello, Bruce.
It has been 3 weeks since my last fish. On my honour, or may I be chopped up and made into soup.
You're an inspiration to all of us.
Amen.
Okay, so this was actually really creative, and it was really refreshing to see sharks portrayed in this way. Finding Nemo was re-released in 2012 in 3D, which was really great. More positive sort of publicity, I guess, for sharks. And Finding Dory, the sequel, is coming out in 2015. Nobody knows anything about the plot yet, but I'm sure the sharks will be back, and I'm hoping that they're just as funny and they're portrayed positively as they were in the original. A little bit more about advances in shark conservation. Over the last 10 years, actually really over the last 5 years, a number of mostly island nations have taken it upon themselves to completely ban shark fishing in their territorial waters. You're going to see them pop up right now. So most of these have been since 2009. These countries recognize the value of live sharks in their ecotourism industry, which is why they stopped fishing for them. And what they've essentially done is establish these shark sanctuaries, which add to the growing worldwide network of no-take marine protected areas, which also serve to protect sharks. Internationally, the Convention on the International Trade of Endangered Species, or CITES, has listed a number of shark species under their Appendix 2. Under Appendix 2, it doesn't completely ban the international trade or fishing of these animals, but it strictly regulates it. You need permits. It makes it a lot more difficult. So in 2002, we had the basking shark and the whale shark added. In 2004, we had the white shark added. Things were a little slow for about 10 years, but just this year, another 5 species were added, the oceanic white tip, the poor beagle shark, and 3 species of hammerhead sharks. In addition, several countries, although they have not stopped shark fishing per se, they have made some efforts to stop shark finning. And these are the countries in purple that you see there that have what are called fins attached laws, meaning that no shark can be landed or brought into port unless the fins are naturally attached to the shark. But unfortunately, if you compare the number of countries with fins attached laws to the top 20 shark fishing countries, which together account for over 75% of the worldwide shark fishing, there's not a whole lot of overlap. So these top 20 countries, Indonesia is leading, followed by India, Spain, Taiwan, and Argentina, rounding out the top 5, followed by Mexico, Pakistan, the United States, Japan, and Malaysia, and then 10 other countries that round out the top 20. If you look at the overlap, only about 17% of the worldwide shark catch is protected from finning by these fins attach laws. So there's a lot more work that needs to be done. Now, a lot more work has also been done in stopping shark fin soup. One thing that has been done, the United States has been a leader in this, state by state, we are banning the sale, trade, possession, and distribution of shark fins, which of course will include shark fin soup being sold at restaurants. Hawaii was the first state, followed by Oregon, Washington, and California, and now it's even spreading to the East Coast and even to the middle of the country with Illinois. Here in San Diego, there were about 20 restaurants that served shark fin soup. But California's law, which was passed in 2011, finally went into effect on July 1st of this year, and so that is no longer the case. And so we're very happy about that. And I'm hoping that the rest of this map will turn green over the next couple of years. There is no excuse. Every state should pass a law like this. Now, even if you ban shark fins, people are still going to get them if they want them. You can ban illicit drugs and people still find ways to get them. So what you need to do to really eliminate the demand is to change the culture. You need to make people not want shark fin soup. You need to make shark fin soup appear unattractive. And a lot of Asian celebrities have taken it upon themselves to take a stand. For example, Yao Ming played for the Houston Rockets, now retired. He worked with a nonprofit organization called Wild Aid to basically take a stand against shark fin soup. And how appropriate that he got his career started playing for the Shanghai Sharks in the Chinese Professional Basketball Association. And Yao Ming and Wild Aid made popular the following phrase: when the buying stops, the killing can too. Simple, powerful, it empowers the consumer to make smart choices. If you stop buying it, there's no economic incentive to kill the sharks. Very simple economics. In addition to that, a couple of other big names in Asia have taken a stand. For example, Hong Kong Disneyland has now stopped serving shark fin soup on all of its menus. Although I do have to say it took some pretty clever marketing and a little bit of prodding to get them to come around. Disneyland Hong Kong, in addition, two of the largest hotel chains that are centered in Hong Kong also eliminated shark fins from their menu. Most recently, there have been campaigns in Hong Kong to encourage newlyweds to forego serving shark fin soup at their wedding banquets. So I'd mentioned this before, but shark fin soup, it's served as a sign of respect to honor guests at wedding banquets, at birthday dinners, things like that, business dealings. And so instead of having shark fin soup, all these newlyweds were entered into competitions, raffles to get prizes like free honeymoons and all kinds of other prizes. So it was very, very successful. And it was called Happy Hearts Love Sharks. And just most recently this year, Cathay Pacific and Dragon Air, the two biggest airlines centered in Hong Kong, have agreed to stop carrying shark fins in their cargo, which is going to limit the movement of shark fins in and out of Hong Kong. It's going to make a difference. I want to end with this. As I said, shark conservation is advancing, but it's advancing too slowly. You saw that we're making progress, but there's a lot more work to be done. There is no time for complacency. I'll end with this. Sharks are wonderful, beautiful, and important animals that must be protected. They're not monsters. They're not mindless eating machines. They're not the devil with jaws. And the only way we can conserve sharks is if we love sharks as much as we love dolphins. Because in the end, we will conserve only what we love, we will love only what we understand, and we will understand only what we are taught. And that's why I'm here tonight, to teach you about sharks so you could understand them a little bit better, maybe even learn to love them and want to conserve and protect them as much as I do. Thank you for your company, and I'm happy to take any questions you have. Sure. So just to repeat the question is, some of these island nations, they're protecting sharks within their territorial waters. Usually what that means is the economic exclusive zone out to 200 miles. So then the other part of the question was, well, how good does that do a whole lot of good considering that sharks can, you know, move around a lot? It's a Do they? And the answer is it depends on the species. Some species have limited movement. They tend to remain close to shore. And if it's an island, they're pretty limited in where they go. But even those species that are typically considered near shore can cross large ocean basins. And certain species like basking sharks, whale sharks, great whites, they can travel thousands of miles. So needless to say, there's more work to be done. But the island nations are doing all that they can. That's the best they could do on their own. And hopefully, if everybody follows suit and we can get some good international laws with all the countries agreeing, then we stand a chance at protecting sharks better. So the question is, over the last 5 or 10 years, what evidence, if there is any, is there that California white shark populations are increasing or decreasing? There's something we talk about called shifting baselines. Where, and I'm sure many of you have heard this in other presentations, where so much time has passed that we don't really know what the historic levels were, right? So some people will say that the shark population has reached its carrying capacity. That's as much as the habitat can sustain. Others will say that it has declined a lot. It seems that the population is relatively small. A recent study estimated about 300, give or take 100 or so, mature individuals. But there's still a lot of debate as to whether it was higher or whether it was about the same, you know, 10, 20, 30 years ago. So the jury is still out, but the population does appear to be small, which makes it vulnerable to being overexploited, which is why we need to protect them. So the question was, what impact, if any, does protecting the seals in La Jolla have on the shark population, namely the white shark population? We don't know. We don't know. Not yet. Sharks will tend to go where there's food, just like we're going to go where there's food, right? We're not going to starve ourselves. If there's no food, we're going to go to where there is food. In other locations, for example, off the coast of Massachusetts, where seal and sea lion populations have increased, there does seem to be also an increase in the white shark population locally there. We have not yet seen that here in La Jolla, or I would say Southern California in general. But no one's really investigated that yet. Okay, so there's still work to be done. We're not quite sure yet what the effect is having or will have on them. No, I don't think so. Oh, so the question was, so Peter Benchley, who wrote the novel Jaws, which the movie Jaws is based on, you know, right before he died, he wrote a book, I think it was called Shark Trouble. Is that, yeah? Where he basically sort of did a 180 and, you know, so what if, is that getting enough publicity? That was the question. It clearly is not, because a lot of people don't know about that. I haven't even read his book, to be honest, so I think the book could probably use some more publicity so if the word can get out. Like, I mean, Peter Benchley did some interviews before he died where he basically regretted ever writing it. He said he would never have written it if he knew the effect it was going to have on people's perception of sharks. You know, coulda, shoulda, woulda. It's too late now, so the important thing is that we're educating people now about sharks and just making them aware of the negative perception out there so that they don't kind of play into that stereotype. So let me see if I get your question right. So marine mammals, local marine mammals, there's evidence that they're starving. Is that indicative of one of these trophic cascades passing through? To be honest, I don't know enough about our local marine mammals and what's happening to them. Are you referring to like a lot of the strandings that have been happening? Right. Yeah, and as far as I know, the strandings are still being investigated, that the cause for that, so I don't yet know exactly what is behind that. These trophic cascades, they're really, those two examples that I showed you, those are still highly debated because there's obviously so many other factors that are kind of at play there. It's not just removing the top predators, it's sort of the bottom-up effects too, changes in the environment. So these are really complicated things. They tend to be correlations, and always establishing causality is really what is so tricky. So unfortunately, I don't have a good answer for your question, but it's a very good one. Was the great white shark that came to La Jolla attracted by the seals or something else? Great white sharks, they're all over San Diego, to be honest. This is where they live. And usually it's actually the baby great whites that live in Southern California. Obviously, they have to be born, and so at times the adults will be down here as well. But this is their home. And whether they're attracted by, you know, sea lions or other fish, it's hard to say. you know, but we have to be mindful that this is their home, and it doesn't really matter why they're here. This is their home, and we need to respect that. So that's a really good question. You know, the question was, do sharks see color? A recent study shows maybe, but probably not. They can see like shades and some maybe certain tones, but not in the way we think of color. But it's really hard to really test for that, to determine whether they can see color. So the question was, the expression yum yum yellow, where sharks were attracted to like yellow clothing or yellow swimsuits or something. Honestly, I don't know where that came from. Maybe we once thought that they were attracted to yellow colors, but it's still unclear whether they can see full color the way we think of it. Yeah, it's a good question. Yes, ma'am. That's a great question. So the question is, did the book Sharks Don't Get Cancer have any impact on shark declines or just anything about sharks? Well, first of all, sharks do get cancer. And the fact that so many people think that they don't get cancer because of that book, if anything, it probably... Well, it maybe made people appreciate sharks a little bit more, but at the same time, we started killing sharks for their cartilage, making cartilage pills because we thought that it was going to cure cancer. And the evidence supporting, like, for example, taking like a cartilage supplement is inconclusive at best. And at worst, you're actually taking in like mercury and other bad stuff that's not going to really help you. So I think that the book maybe did hurt a little bit because people started to harvest sharks more. And there was really no reason to do that. Good question. So the question is, what kind of sharks are usually finned, or is it just whatever sharks are captured, those are the ones that are finned? Whatever ones are captured, those are the ones that are finned. But usually, depending on where you are, if you're out in the open ocean, the blue shark is probably one of the most common sharks that are caught. And so for that reason, they're one of the most commonly finned species, and they have really long fins too. So the shape of the fin, the texture of the fin, that all plays into the value of it. Certain species have higher quality fins than others. Other species that are going to be pretty high, oceanic white tips, really big paddle-like fins. So certain species are valued more, but not necessarily targeted, right? It's whatever they find, they'll catch, but certain ones are going to be worth more than others. The question is, how do I go about catching a shark? So it's going to be, very carefully, watching out for the mouth. It depends on the species of shark. If it's a leopard shark, you can just use a hand line. So just like a plastic spool with a hook baited with a piece of mackerel. And it's a little exciting without the rod and reel, but all you need is a hand line. And then once you get the shark close, use a net, you scoop them up so that you kind of stabilize the shark. Then you can take the hook out, tag it, measure it, and then release it. Other species like a white shark or anything that's really big is going to be a lot more complicated, and you tend to need to be a little bit more creative in what you do. Sometimes for a thresher shark, for example, you're going to want to use you're going to want your bait to be floating about 20, 30 feet below the surface, right? So you're going to want to have the bait there, and you're going to want to have a float near the top, and then that's how you're going to fish, and you're going to fish farther offshore. So it really depends on the species and its behavior, and that would dictate how you go about trying to catch it. So the question is, what can the average person do to help shark conservation? When the buying stops, the killing can too. I would say the biggest thing that the everyday person can do is to make smart consumer choices. Don't buy shark meat. Don't buy shark fin soup. If we stop and tell your friends not to do the same, that's the easiest thing that we can all do. Because if we stop the demand, then there will be no more fishing for sharks, no more finning sharks. Besides that, there might be certain nonprofit organizations that have, rallies or other events where they might need volunteers. That could be another way to get involved. But something that everybody can do, just don't buy shark meat. Or if you go fishing for sharks, consider releasing it. Maybe don't bring it back. Take a picture and release it. That's what I would say. Sure. So we've got the direct benefits to humans, which are a protein source. A lot of people require that. We have the benefit of having increased revenue for local communities through ecotourism. And the ecological role is that the sharks are top predators. And as such, as I said, they directly control their prey populations. So here you have sharks. So, 30 years ago, we had sharks, we had their prey, and then we had the prey's prey. As sharks have gone down, their prey has gone up, and then what these guys eat has gone down. So sort of you get this sort of seesaw effect through the ecosystem. And as I said, all we can really look at right now are the correlations, right? We can say that shark populations have gone down, ray populations have gone up, bay scallops have gone down. We know about the diets of each of these. We can try to draw those causal links. It's a complicated process. And unfortunately, we may not fully understand the impact of removing sharks until it's too late. So this is why we need to take preventative measures to stop it from happening and to immediately mitigate the shark population that has already declined. It's a good question. It's a tough answer, though.
Well, I'm sure Andy will take further questions afterward, but let's thank him again for really interesting.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.